as we pray and ask the Lord to use these weeks for His glory. We've been traveling through the Gospel of Mark since March. And as we've walked through this book together, we have gone up on high mountains to see these amazing views of who Jesus is. We've seen that He is this miracle-working King who came to earth to establish His kingdom. We've seen that He is the promised Messiah who came to earth to rescue His people. And we've walked through valleys as well to see why He came. That He came to suffer. He came to be rejected. He came to die and to rise again in order to forgive sins, to defeat evil, to save lost souls. And this journey through the Gospel of Mark has taken us high and low. It's taken us around curves and down straight level paths. But the section of Mark that we come to today, and that you, many of you studied in your life class this morning, it could feel like we've lost the trail completely as we go through the Gospel of Mark. It could feel like everything has just totally gone in a weird direction. Let's go ahead and turn to Mark chapter 13, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Mark chapter 13. Mark is the second book in the New Testament, second half of the Bible, Mark chapter 13. And if you want to use the church Bible in front of you, it's on page 849. 849. As we come to Mark 13, I don't think it's a dead end. I don't think it's a detour. I think it's meant to strengthen our grip on who Jesus is. It's meant to strengthen our grip on why He came so that it will strengthen our faithfulness to follow Him. In these verses, Jesus wants His disciples and Jesus wants Christians today to look ahead, to look to the future. But we got to be careful because when you get a group of people, specifically a group of Christians or church people together, and you tell everyone to open their Bibles and then talk about the future, things can get crazy. Things can get a little weird, a little strange. But that's not our goal this morning. Even though this is a more technical part of the trail through Mark's gospel, we should approach it with humility here. It's not easy to fully understand or grasp, and there are faithful, committed Christians who don't agree on all the details of what's being said here, and that's okay. My goal is to walk us through this chapter, staying as close to the foundational points as possible, without getting lost into the details. We'll step into some of the details, but I want to make sure we don't mistake the edge of the trail for the middle of the trail. So I want to lay down three landmarks for us that you can take and hold on to and maybe dive more into chapter 13 on your own. Three landmarks to guide us. And they're all worded as kind of both and language, because when it comes to discussions about what the Bible teaches about the future, a lot of people can drift into, well, it's either or. It's either this or this. But I think when it comes to what the Bible teaches about what's to come, both and language is a lot more helpful than either or. So the points are going to be this. We'll see that Jesus is talking about things that are now and later. Jesus is talking about things getting worse and better. And Jesus is talking about things that are known and unknown. Now and later, worse and better, known and unknown. Let's jump into the first one, now and later. The majority of this chapter is Jesus' teaching. But it's important for us to understand what He's teaching in response to. His teaching comes in response to something the disciples see and then something they say to Him. Let's look at chapter 13, verse 1. As He came out of the temple, one of His disciples said to Him, "Look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." And Jesus said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? There will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." A lot of what takes place before this in Mark 11 and 12 takes place in the temple. We saw that last week. But Jesus and His disciples now are leaving the temple. And keep in mind, this is just a few days from when Jesus is going to die on the cross. Keep that in mind as we're going through this. But as they leave the temple, the disciples are blown away by the impressiveness of the temple complex. And it was impressive. You had this temple that was improved and expanded upon by Herod the Great, and he turned it into this large, beautiful complex in Jesus' day. And the disciples say, "Isn't this place amazing?" And Jesus says, "Well, there's coming a day when none of these buildings are going to be left standing." It can sound a little bit like Jesus is being pretty Debbie Downer. I mean, they're all excited. "This is so awesome." And Jesus is like, "Yeah, but it's all going to be destroyed." He's not trying to be this negative guy who's bringing everybody's spirits down. He's trying to redirect their attention and redirect their hearts and redirect their focus here. Because if this is true, if it's true that there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down, as Jesus says, that's a major disaster. Something significant is going to take place for that to happen. Well, they continue walking out of the temple and they head toward the Mount of Olives, which is east of Jerusalem. And as they're sitting there together looking at the temple, the disciples want to know more about what Jesus is talking about. Look at verse 3. As he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter and James and John and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished?" So there's two parts to what the disciples ask Jesus. They ask him, "When will these things happen?" And they ask him, "What are going to be the signs that these things are about to happen? When's it going to happen? And how are we going to know when it's going to happen?" The way the disciples are talking and thinking here, it makes it seem like they're equating the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple with the end of the world. I mean, think about it. Like, for generations and generations of the people of God, everything revolved around the temple. And to hear someone say it's going to be destroyed, it's hard to envision a future past that for them. And so they're thinking, well, if this is going to happen, when will these things be means when's the end of the world going to be? The signs that are this is about to happen means what are the signs that the world's about to end? And Jesus answers their questions by correcting their thinking at first. Verse 5. Jesus began to say to them, "See that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name saying, 'I am he,' and they will lead many astray. And when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. These are but the beginning of the birth pains." So I don't think they realize it yet, but the disciples are asking Jesus about two separate events. They're asking Jesus about two separate events, the end of Jerusalem and his return, the end of the world. And Jesus is clarifying these things for them. Here's where I think Jesus is redirecting them. He tells them in verse 5, "See that no one leads you astray." So he's saying, don't let people trick you into thinking. Don't let other teachers come along when Jerusalem is destroyed and make you think this is what it's really not. And then he goes on to tell them in verse 7, at the end of verse 7, he says, "This must take place, but the end is not yet." It won't be over at that point. The world is not ending at that point. And he tells them in verse 8 that when all these different things happen, these are the beginning of the birth pains. It's the end of Jerusalem, but it's not the end of his plan in this world. It's not the end of his purposes. It's not the time when he's going to return. Here's why this matters. Because as we read the rest of this chapter, I think we need to read the rest of the chapter with both events in our minds. With the end of Jerusalem in our minds, the destruction of the temple, and Jesus' his return in our minds. Essentially, looking at this chapter with two lenses, with bifocals in a sense on, where we can look near and see what's going to happen immediately, and look far and see what's going to happen way down the road. If you only read it with one of the events in mind, you're going to end up really confused. There's already enough in here that's confusing, but you'll end up even more confused. So let's have both of these things in mind. I'm just trying to lay the foundation for what I think Jesus is talking about to the disciples, because if we don't understand what this meant to the disciples, we can't make the connection to what this means for us. I think in verses 5 all the way down through verse 23, I think Jesus is primarily talking about the temple and the city of Jerusalem being destroyed. There's room to disagree here and to kind of nuance different details, but let me show you a couple reasons why. Let's go to verse 9. Jesus says in verse 9, "Be on your guard, for they will deliver you over to councils, and you will be beaten in synagogues, and you will stand before governors and kings for my sake to bear witness before them." So this repetition, he's talking to the disciples. This is going to happen to you. You're going to go through this. You are going to experience this. And then if you jump with me down to verse 14, Jesus says, "But when you see the abomination of desolation standing where he ought not to be, let the reader understand." I think it's because some of those things are about to happen in Mark's day. "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." Well, if those who are in Judea are going to flee to the mountains, I think it shows Jesus is thinking of events that are going to happen in their lifetime, in the generation that he's speaking to. And then he says these unique things in verse 16. "Let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that it may not happen in winter." If Jesus was talking about the end of the world, the time of his return, why would it be worse to be in Jerusalem? And why would it matter if it was wintertime? So I think he's talking about this specific event that's going to happen in Jerusalem with the temple. So there's this immediate future. There's the now for them. And then in verse 24 is where Jesus begins talking about the distant future, the much later. Let's jump in at chapter 13, verse 24. "But in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. And then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven." Notice Jesus switches from talking about specific details on a local and global scale to talking more general events on a cosmic scale. He's talking stars and sun and moon. We're going to dive more into the details of these sections in the next point. But the big takeaway here is that Jesus can predict what's going to take place, whether it's something now or later, immediate future or distant future, because it's all under his control. The reason he can say the end is not yet, this has to take place, is because he's driving the whole thing. He's the one controlling how future unfolds. And he's preparing his disciples and us, not just by teaching us the details of the plan, but also pointing our attention to the one who designed the plan. Jesus tells his disciples after he dies on the cross, rises from the dead, and appears to them and gets ready to send them out into the world. He tells them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." We need this because it shows us that everything that happens from this point in Mark 13 to the end of Jerusalem decades later, to the second coming of Jesus, is all happening according to God's good and wise purposes. It gives us something to hold on to when our feelings say otherwise. It gives us something to hold on to when our thoughts say otherwise. It gives us something to hold on to when our circumstances say otherwise. No amount of evil, no level of disaster can knock God off his throne. He has been there for all eternity. He is there right now, and he will be there forever. So that's our first landmark to guide us in this chapter and in life in general: God's control over the now and the later. The second is this: worse and better. Worse and better. Keep in mind, Jesus is responding to those two questions that Peter, James, John, and Andrew originally asked him. When are these things going to happen? And what are the signs that are going to be leading up to that? In answering that second question, Jesus points out various signs that are going to accompany the two events he's talking about, the destruction of Jerusalem and his return to the world. He's not creating a timeline here. He's creating more of an expectation. Here's what to expect in the immediate future as you follow me. Here's what to expect in the distant future for future generations of those who follow me. He's not trying to give us things that we could track and say, okay, this happened, now this happened. It seems like 2 weeks from now, Jesus is going to come back. That's not the goal here. He creates this expectation by explaining what kinds of signs to look for. And notice as we go through this, it's more than just one kind of sign. He shows signs of opposition, but then signs of opportunity for the gospel. He shows signs of conflict, but also signs of comfort. He shows signs of grief, but also signs of his grace. Jesus is teaching that the world is going to get worse and it's going to get better at the same time. Let's revisit a couple parts and you'll see this mixture I'm talking about, worse and better. He tells the disciples back in verse 6 of chapter 13, back in verse 6, he says, many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and they will lead many astray. And when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. These are but the beginning of the birth pains. So he describes this world in tension, this world that feels the effects of sin and the effects of the fall. He describes this creation that's groaning to be redeemed by the King of the world, like Romans 8 talks about. And then he tells them in verse 9 that they will deliver you over to councils, and you will be beaten in synagogues, and you will stand before governors and kings for my sake. And he echoes similar conflict down in verse 12. Brother will deliver brother over to death, and the father, his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death. He's saying the world is going to oppose the gospel more and more. I don't have to say a lot to convince you of the fact that we live in a world that pushes back on the truth of the gospel, and it will not be easy to faithfully follow Jesus in this world. But remember, Jesus is creating an expectation. We should not be surprised by the fact that it's not easy to be a Christian in our day. It's never been easy in any day to follow Jesus. We should not be surprised at various conflicts and various crises that take place in our world. It doesn't mean we don't mourn them or grieve. It doesn't mean that they're not hard and difficult. It just means they should not surprise us. But we should also not be surprised that God's still working in the midst of it all. Not just opposition, remember, also opportunity. Not just conflict, also comfort. Not just grief, but also grace, worse and better. Tucked into there in chapter 19, we read around it, but now let's read in the middle of it. Back in verse 9, where he's telling them, you're going to be delivered over. You're going to be beaten in synagogues. You're going to have to stand before governors and kings. Then verse 10, he says, and the gospel must first be proclaimed to all nations. That's another one of the signs. The gospel is going to need to go out to all nations. And how's that going to happen? Well, he tells them in verse 11, when they bring you to trial and deliver you over, don't be anxious beforehand what you are to say. But say whatever is given you in that hour, for it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. He says it's going to be hard. There's going to be opposition, but the gospel is going to go out and the Holy Spirit is going to lead you and speak through you the truths of the gospel. Even during the wars and rumors of wars, even during the conflicts and the crises, the work of God continues. The gospel continues to spread and broken people continue to be made whole by Jesus Christ. This is part of the message about the destruction of Jerusalem and about the destruction of the temple that Jesus is communicating to his disciples. He didn't want them to think that Jerusalem was so important to the purposes of God that if it was destroyed, his plan was destroyed. The destruction of Jerusalem happened. The temple was destroyed. But the gospel of Jesus wasn't destroyed. Even when it happened, the church of Jesus was not destroyed. The message kept going out. The word kept spreading. People kept coming to Christ because in the middle of the opposition and conflict, there's still grace at work. Think about this. I said this earlier. This is just a few days before Jesus goes to the cross. Just a couple days after he speaks these words, he's going to be hanging and dying and bleeding on a cross. The scene of the greatest evil in the history of the world is also the scene of the greatest work of salvation in the history of the world. The scene of the greatest darkness there has ever been is also the scene of the greatest light there has ever been. The time when evil seemed to be at its strongest, God's work was even stronger and his plan was in complete control the whole time. You know, even in our world today, there's more opposition to the gospel than there has ever been. But there's also more believers in our world than there has ever been. The gospel keeps going. It keeps spreading. And this is all moving towards what Jesus says in verse 26, that then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory, and he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds and from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. So Jesus shows them a glimpse of what all this is moving towards to fuel what they're doing right now. He's saying, the gospel is only kind of in this one location now, but it's going to keep going out and spreading through you. And when the Son of Man comes back, when I return, I'm going to be bringing my people from every corner of the world. That wasn't their experience then, but that's where things were going to go. The message for those following Christ now, for those of you in this room that have trusted Christ and you are, so maybe you have your one in mind, somebody that you've been praying for to trust Christ. The message for us now is that difficult and concerning parts of our world are not reasons to stop sharing the gospel. The challenges of our culture are not reasons to stop sharing the gospel. If anything, these are the times when the message of the gospel is most needed. And they can be times when some of the strongest movements of God take place. I think you and I would like to try to write the script of how a revival could happen or how the gospel could spread, but God knows far better than we do. He knows what plan is best because he's the one writing it. So our second landmark along this path is the truth that the accomplishment of God's saving plan will be carried out through things getting worse and things getting better. And then lastly, our last landmark is known and unknown. Known and unknown. The final section of Mark 13 gives us Jesus' main point, I think. I think it's what he's been building to as he's been teaching the disciples. And there's still a handful of things in here that I'm just not fully sure how to wrap my mind around or connect with. But you can still understand the main point without fully understanding those subpoints. And it's a point that Jesus is making that's been hinted at and sprinkled throughout this chapter. But it really comes to the forefront starting in verse 32. The very last paragraph, verse 32, where Jesus is talking again about his second coming. He says in verse 32, but concerning that day or that hour, no one knows, in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Be on guard. Keep awake, for you do not know when the time will come. It's like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his servants in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to stay awake. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening or at midnight, or when the rooster crows or in the morning, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. And what I say to you, I say to all, stay awake. Jesus is teaching that his return, the ultimate goal of all that God is doing in the universe, is both known and unknown. We know that it's going to happen, but we don't know when it's going to happen. We know it will happen, but we don't know when it will happen. And he says in verse 32 that concerning that day or that hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. He says God the Father has written the timeline of when Jesus will return to earth to fully set up his kingdom, to fulfill all promises, to get rid of all evil. Only the Father knows. The exact timing is hidden from angels, Son, from Jesus, I think in his human nature. And it's hidden from people. People of every generation, since Jesus first spoke these words, have tried to predict when Jesus will come back. And people of every generation have had circumstances they could point to that would say, it looks like it's going to be soon. It looks like it's going to happen. I'm not talking about the kind of people who like nail down an exact day. I'm talking about even people that think, man, I've been watching the news and seeing these different things and what's happening over in Israel and seeing this. I think it's going to happen soon. That's not the kind of readiness Jesus is talking about. And Jesus is saying, no one knows. No one knows the hour. No one knows the day. And no prediction has ever been able to override God's timeline. No prediction has ever been able to override God's power. So we don't know when, but we do know what our response should be. That's what Jesus tells us in verse 33. He says, be on guard, keep awake, for you don't know when the time will come. So because we don't know, our calling is to be on guard, to be awake. This is the key piece of the whole chapter, I think. It's the piece that connects the events Jesus is talking about. Destruction of Jerusalem, his second coming, with the way followers of him are to respond now. Be on guard. Keep awake. Stay alert. Stay ready. So he's redirecting their attention away from that impressive temple, away from their two questions, all to the issue of readiness, preparedness. And he tells a short parable to show what he means. He says in verse 34, it's like a man going on a journey. When he leaves home and puts his servants in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to stay awake. So Jesus says this whole kind of known unknown dynamic is like the master of a house who goes away on a trip and leaves his servants in charge of the house while he's gone. Each servant has their own responsibilities to carry out while he's gone, and it's the responsibility of the doorkeeper to stay awake, he says. The fact that the master left doesn't change the doorkeeper's job. In fact, it makes the doorkeeper's job even more important than if he was there. The doorkeeper can't do his job if he gets distracted by lesser things. The doorkeeper can't do his job if he's spending his time trying to calculate when the master's going to come back. He does his job by staying alert. And that's what Jesus says our job is. He makes the connection for us in verse 35. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house, he's talking about himself, when he's going to come, in the evening, at midnight, when the rooster crows, in the morning, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. And then he applies this to all of us. Verse 37, what I say to you, I say to all, stay awake. Staying awake means living with readiness, means living with alertness. It means living every day in light of the truth. Jesus is going to come back, but you don't know when he's going to come back. So because we know he will return, we live with urgency, always looking for ways to obey Jesus, always looking for opportunities to tell other people about Jesus. But because we don't know when he will return, we live faithfully. We engage in our relationships and our families. We engage in our jobs. We engage in churches with a faithful obedience to Jesus because His return is near. His return is the next big event on God's calendar. I don't think readiness is the way you might say when you were a kid and you're getting ready to go spend the night at a friend's house and your friend and his mom are going to come pick you up. And so you got all your stuff and you're just like sitting out on the front porch just looking for them to come, waiting. I see there's lights coming. No, it's not them. And then finally their car turns and you're just ready to run out. I don't think readiness for us is disengage from everything else and just sit and wait. I think it's more like we keep serving, we keep doing things, and for that kid, you're still helping clean up the house, you're still doing the stuff you're supposed to do, and then next thing you know, your friend and his mom are here to pick you up, but you've been faithful to your role at home the whole time. I think it's engaging more in this world. I think it's being faithful here, because this important realization is that the Bible's teaching about the future is not meant to stir up controversy. It's not meant to stir up speculation. It's meant to stir up this daily urgent obedience. That this reality that Jesus is going to come back is the fuel for our faithfulness. As we talked about, we have these 2 weeks coming up, LaGrange Missions and VBS. We do these events because we believe Jesus is coming back. We're going to serve our community this week because we believe Jesus is coming back. We're inviting all kinds of kids to come from our community next week at VBS because we believe Jesus is coming back. Broader than that, as followers of Jesus, we aim to be faithful employees, to be faithful students at school, to be faithful in marriage, to be faithful in singleness, to be faithful in public, to be faithful in private. We aim to be faithful in joy and in sorrow because Jesus came and He's coming again. We don't know when, but we know He will. And so we serve day after day after day, eagerly anticipating that final day. This chapter may have looked like a dead end or a detour at first, but I think now we see it gives us just as incredible view of Jesus as the rest of Mark's gospel does. We see that whether something now or later, Jesus is in control and all of history is moving towards the throne of God. We see that the world is getting better, it's getting worse and nothing's going to work properly yet. We also see the world's getting better because the enduring hope of the gospel is on the move and it won't stop. We see that Jesus' return is known and unknown. We don't know when it will happen, but we know it will. So we stay awake, we stay prepared, we strive to be faithful day after day. There's a quote I'd like to read you to wrap up here this morning that I think just brings together a lot of the things that we have talked about. It's written by a pastor named J.C. Ryle, who was a pastor back in the 1800s. And he's just expressing the experience of being a Christian in this world and knowing that now and that later, the worse and the better, the known and the unknown. And you'll see it on the screen because I want you to be able to follow along with me, but just receive this, hear this, take this in as I read it. He says, "I dare say you often feel your heart faint and are sorely tempted to give up in despair. Your enemies seem so many, your besetting sin so strong, your friends so few, the way so steep and narrow, you hardly know what to do. But I still say, persevere and press on. The time is very short. A few more years of watching and praying, a few more tossings of the sea of this world, a few more deaths and changes, a few more winters and summers, and all will be over. We shall have fought our last battle and shall need to fight no more. The presence and company of Christ will make amends for all we suffer here below. Let us take courage. We are not far from home. It may cost much to be a true Christian, but it pays. Stay alert. Be ready. Grief will come. His grace is still working. And the glory of Jesus is on the way." Let's pray together.